Chiland Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the first episode of the week of the Calcioland podcast. So today we're going to focus mainly on what's been going on in Serie A. We'll have a winners and losers segment to discuss the last few match days in Serie A. We have our dear friend Thousand Names with some game picks for the upcoming games as well. We are going to talk about just one big transfer story on a player we've discussed numerous times over the years on the pod. But the headline and the main course, if you will, of today's podcast is the first half of a great chat I had with our dear friend, the Napoli Outsider. We changed things up a little bit. Instead of talking about Napoli, we went around Serie A. So you'll hear the first part of the interview today. We'll run the second part of the interview just for our patrons later this week. But before we get to all that, we are joined by our dear friend, the producer, co-host of the show, Alex Goldberg. And Alex, I've been thinking about this question for a while, and you obviously with Chelsea have experience with a former player taking over and doing really well with Frank Lampard. So there's two players that have been in the headlines in the Calcio world of potentially becoming coaches, two of the players from the 2006 World Cup team. So we have De Rossi, who was heavily linked to Fiorentina, although Comiso called it fake news. And we have Pirlo, who is going to coach Juve's under-23 team. In a way, they're kind of grooming him to potentially be their manager down the road. So I'm going to ask you, Alex, since you have the experience with Lampard, in your opinion, looking from the outside, if you had to bet 5 years from now, who do you think we're going to look as a better manager between Pirlo and De Rossi?
You know, David, my answer is going to be really silly because I don't know these guys as human beings, maybe as well as some of our Calcio listeners and yourself. However, I still feel confident in my shallow line of thinking here. I'm going to say De Rossi's the better manager. And I say that more because, like, I don't think someone like Pirlo, who I view at Vineyards being like the most composed and smart and cool and suave guy, I don't view him as necessarily being what a manager needs to be. Now, first of all, I do understand, on the contrary, that he understands the game brilliantly. I'm not doubting his football IQ. I think he's probably got a supreme football IQ, similar to Frank Lampard. But I don't know. There's something about the way I see Pirlo kind of relaying his message to players where some might be like, yeah, whatever you say, you got it. But with others, I don't know. Does he have manager in him? I'm also coming under a really stereotypical line of thinking of what a manager or a coach is like in American sports. And often people with the composure and the poise of Pirlo don't really make great coaches. I'm sure there are examples to go against it, but from an aesthetic standpoint, now we're getting really silly. De Rossi also looks like a good manager. He just looks like a good manager to me. He just gives off that vibe. So I think both, obviously, they wouldn't have been the players they were, and they were very smart players who clearly understood what was happening in front of them, behind them, to the left and to the right. I think they clearly have the knowledge to be good managers. But in terms of actually relaying the message and being everything else that a manager includes, I feel like De Rossi's got a little bit more of that than Pirlo. That is just my take, and I'm interested to hear yours, David. So what's yours?
Yeah, no, I like your way of thinking. You know, what's interesting is Pirlo said that when he was a player, he never saw himself as becoming a coach until he saw Conte at Juve, and how Conte essentially turned around his career, which was floundering, turned Juve's fortunes around and whatnot. So it's interesting that Pirlo had an epiphany with Conte. De Rossi, you know, I think he exudes leadership, and, you know, we know of him as a player, as a leader at Roma, even with the Italian national team. You know, just think of the famous thing with Ventura, the last match against Sweden, where Ventura told him to start warming up, and he's like, what do you need me to warm up for? We need to win, put a forward in. I mean, De Rossi has had a lot of moments like that in his career. you know, that show leadership. I'm not surprised that Fiorentina really kind of looked at him as a potential savior. Now, granted, I think they reconsidered, you know, if it's worthy for them to gamble on him, you know, as a team that has struggled to avoid relegation in recent years. So it's interesting. I feel like they're coming at this, becoming a manager from different perspectives. I think that Ossi for years kind of knew that he was headed that path, and Pirlo realized it late in his career. You know, what's interesting to me is the path that they're probably going to take to this. I really like the path that Juve is putting Pirlo on. I think they're trying to develop, if you win, their own Guardiola in-house, putting him with the under-23 team, making him pay his dues. I mean, it's not surprising that in the Italian media, there was already buzz that Pirlo could replace Sarri in season. Now, probably the less reliable Italian media. So he'll always kind of be a shadow on the Juve manager, if you will. But I like the path that he's on. But also, I'm curious to see what he does. I have the impression that it's probably more likely than not that he would want a shot at a top club, you know, not necessarily a top club, but a Serie A team right away. Maybe a little bit the Pippo Inzaghi model, although he coached the Primavera first. So it's an interest dichotomy. Looking at the personality of the player, I'm with you to the demeanor that Pirlo has, but also the way that he played, the way he saw the game. I'm just not sure that is something you can coach. I think that is something that you either you have it or not. I view De Rossi's qualities as a player as maybe more something that you can coach up effort-wise. Think of like Gattuso, and I really enjoyed what our friend Daniela, who was on last week, talked about the qualities of Gattuso as a human being, how they translate as a manager, and I could absolutely see that with De Rossi as well. So I'm going to say I'm more optimistic about De Rossi long-term, but I will say I think the way Pirlo is going about it with the under-23 team being groomed in-house at Juve does sound to me like a possible recipe for success. I'm curious to see what path De Rossi will take to eventually becoming a manager on a top team.
All right, David, so there's some pretty big news out there that I saw yesterday. And it makes me a little nervous. Well, not really nervous, because now I sound really ridiculous since Chelsea are seemingly getting a lot closer to Kai Havertz and are having an incredible window, which hasn't even opened yet. But it does make me a little nervous when I know Manchester City no longer have a ban. And now they're linked to Koulibaly. And they're not just linked to Koulibaly. They're linked to Koulibaly through you guys, through Di Marzio's camp, which means there's actually credibility to it. So can you please enlighten me and anyone listening on the latest regarding Napoli, Koulibaly, and whatever his future may be?
Yeah, so there was the report yesterday. Di Marzio tweeted that Ramadani, who is kind of working as an intermediary in this deal, had dinner with De Laurentiis over the weekend, and he expressed that Manchester City are interested in Koulibaly. Now, De Laurentiis' answer was like, okay, great, but the starting price is 75 million. And at this point, at those figures, it doesn't sound like City are interested. Now, a lot's been made about this, so let's try to unpack this on a couple of different ways. I think this shows a lot of strength for Napoli, that this is their demand for Koulibaly. A, we know they're about to splurge, if this deal goes over the finish line, a lot of money on Osimhen. But as we discussed on the podcast, this isn't necessarily tied to Koulibaly. There's multiple players that Napoli has out on loan with forced option to buy where they're going to cash in. There's Verdi, Rog, Inglese, Chiriches, and there's others as well. I've seen some people say that that transfer kitty is over the 60 million that it's going to cost to bring in Osimhen. So that's great. Show its strength. They're going to break their transfer record if they get that over the finish line, and Koulibaly doesn't need to be sacrificed there. The other thing is, you could argue, you know, Koulibaly's turned 29 recently. He's been playing a lot better, but he didn't have a good start to the season. And realistically, this is the last time Napoli can make a huge return on him. But Napoli doesn't have to sell him. They don't need the money. We know Koulibaly told Gazzetta dello Sport that if De Laurentiis offers him one more contract in addition to the one that he's already on, he's fine to retiring at Napoli. So he put the ball back in De Laurentiis' court, and he said he never asked to be sold. So Napoli knows that he's happy to stay. He's on the contract for multiple seasons. There's really no urgency to sell him. So Napoli put themselves in a position that the only offer they'll really consider is one that is really hard to refuse, one that Koulibaly would want to accept. You would think Manchester City playing at that level, contending in the Champions League and the Premier League, and I'm sure he'd be earning a lot more than he does at Napoli, would make sense. But Napoli's like, okay, you're going to have to make him happy and us happy. So to me, kudos for Napoli for putting themselves in this position. You really can't say that for almost any other Serie A team that they are in this spot, Juve and Inter. But even then, they would have to really consider the potential of making a huge plusvalenza there. So as it stands now, Alex, I think you can feel pretty comfortable that Napoli will only sell on their terms. And let's see if Manchester City is going to be willing to meet that price.
Should be interesting. They're certainly going to be a lot louder now that their future is a little bit more clear. All right, David. Well, let's get to some winners and losers. And let's start off on the positive end of things. Who are some winners?
Yeah, so I recapped the main big storylines in Serie A. These are covering the games from Saturday to Monday. Let's give huge credit to Milan. Keep putting up a ton of goals. 5 goals against Bologna. Calhanoglu has been really outstanding in recent weeks. So let's give him some credit. Milan always changes the manager, but he always stays in the starting lineup. I think he's really taken a leap forward playing with Ibrahimovic and for Pioli. We have Rebic, who keeps scoring goals. Milan is going to meet with his agent to try to redeem him as quickly as possible. Another strong game by Theo Hernandez. So big credit to Milan and Pioli. Let's give some credit to Verona, who were able to draw against Atalanta. I thought Juric, their manager, had an excellent game plan. I think the fact that they were able to draw against Atalanta without their best defender, Kumbula, who's out for the remainder of the season, is very impressive. Shout out to Zapata, who did score in this game for Atalanta. And then we had Pessina, who is on loan at Verona from Atalanta, who tied the match. Then we had that excellent game between Roma and Inter. We had Mkhitaryan, ninth goal of the season. He's been really excellent, plays off really well with Dzeko. We have defender Ibanez, another Atalanta player who left and who's doing well at Roma. On the Inter side, Alexis Sanchez, another strong game. Let's give credit to Gagliardini. I think all too often we remember that horrible miss that he has had since Calcio came back, but he's been quite good beyond that as well. And Lukaku, who made a big impact off the bench. Then we had Fiorentina's win against Torino, which clinched that they avoided relegations. They have more points than last season, which they said was their first objective of the season. So congrats for reaching that. We had Kwame, his first start back. There was an own goal that he essentially created. Kudos to him. Cutrone scored again off the bench. Strong game by Ribéry. Then we had Napoli with a late game winner by Politano against Udinese. Then let's give some love to Sampdoria, who pretty much avoided relegation with their win at Parma. Great job by Ranieri. Mission accomplished. Took over to avoid relegation and did so. And then we had Juve's win against Lazio yesterday, all but clinching the Scudetto. Ronaldo with a brace. Dybala, who wasn't supposed to start the game. Higuain was a late scratch, slight injury in warm-ups. Had another really, really strong game. I think we've answered the question if Ronaldo and Dybala can play together. That certainly seems to work quite well for Juve. Let's give credit to Sarri. Look, I think he's been a disappointment overall, but one thing he deserves credit is that Dybala's career at Juve has really completely turned around. This time last year, he was being shopped to make a big plusvalenza, and now Juve are ready to give him a big contract. So I think we can at least give that to Sarri, that he definitely helped save Dybala's career at Juve.
Yeah, that's a huge plus. A huge plus in Sarri's column, because the world of football needs Paulo Dybala being Paulo Dybala as an objective, as a neutral. When watching Juve, I couldn't stand by that statement more. All right, David. Well, there's a yin and a yang, like I always say. So who are our losers?
Just a few. Let's start with Torino, whose defense has been absolutely catastrophic against Fiorentina. Another really poor display, especially Bianco, really, really struggling. Torino, I think, is definitely one of the biggest letdown teams of the season. And then let's talk a little bit about the battle to avoid relegation. Spal mathematically relegated after losing to Brescia. We had Lecce, who lost a huge match to Genoa, now 4 points behind in the race to avoid relegation. Huge win for Genoa. We had Mancuso, who had scored a bunch of penalties this season, now misses two in a row. And last losers are the horrible coaching changes we had in season in Serie A. Di Biagio at Spal, absolutely dreadful job. Zenga at Cagliari, I mean, they were really lucky to get a draw against Sassuolo. I mean, Sassuolo had the ball pretty much the whole match. Zenga, to me, another really inept manager. So Diego Lopez at Brescia. So those are winners and losers. Now let's get to our dear friend, Thousand Names. Let's take a look at the upcoming games. He sent me some game picks. As always, I take them a little bit with a grain of salt. So let's start with Lazio hosting Cagliari. And Immobile and Thousand has Lazio winning 3-0, hat-trick by Immobile. He said that Chiro is going to gain back the golden boot and the virtual Ballon d'Or with this performance. He says that Cagliari coach Zenga is going to throw this game just to see a Ronaldo cry over losing the golden boot. And he says Limone Inzaghi, which is Lemon Inzaghi, Thousand's nickname for Inzaghi, is going to refine his dignity and now believes in the Scudetto. Again, in Italian, Lazio Cagliari 3-0, Immobile tripletta, Ciro si prende la scarpa d'oro, il pallone d'oro virtuale, Zenga si scansa pur di vedere Ronaldo in lacrime, Limone Inzaghi ritrova la dignità e crede ancora allo Scudetto. I will give Lazio the win as well, I just don't buy Cagliari. Lazio, look, they were decimated against Juve. I thought they played okay, but I'm going to go just 1-0, and I'll give a goal to Caicedo. Next up, and Inter has to win. If not, Juve has a chance to clinch the Scudetto this later this week. Hosting Fiorentina, Thousand has them winning 3-0, goals by Candreva, Moses, and Brozovic. And he says Conte gets closer to Sarri thanks to the quality of his midfielders. He says Ribery is going to be humbled by Bastoni and that Commisso is going to really enjoy because he knows this loss to Inter is going to hurt Juve. In Italian, Inter Fiorentina 3-0, Candreva, Moses, Brozovic, Conte accorcia su Sarri con la qualità dei centrocampisti, Ribery umiliato da Bastoni, Commisso gode alla faccia di Nedved. I'm going to go Inter win by 1-0, and I'll give a goal to Lukaku. Last match, Udinese hosting Juve, and Thousand does believe Inter will get back into the Scudetto race because he has Udinese winning 2-0. Goals by DePaul and Striker Larsson. And he says Udinese coach is going to get his revenge on Sarri because he preferred Martuscello at Juve. Gotti used to be an assistant with Sarri, I think at Chelsea also. But that when Sarri went to Juve, he brought Martuscello, who was with him at Empoli. A good observation by Thousand. And he points out that Gotti was the real manager at Chelsea and that Ronaldo is in tears because he also lost the golden boot. And this was a disastrous season for him and Juve. In Italian, Udinese, Juve 2-0, De Paul, Striker, Larsson. Gotti si riprende la rivincita su Sarri, che gli ha preferito Martuscello alla Juve. Era lui il vero allenatore del Chelsea. Ronaldo in lacrime per aver perso anche la scarpa d'oro. Stagione disastrosa. I'm going to go a draw. I'll go 1-1. I'll give a goal to Lasagna, who is red hot. And I'll give a goal to Rabiot, who has been frisky for Juve. So before we get to our great friend, Napoli Outsider, the first part of this interview is going to be available to all, and I think you'll really enjoy it. Let's get to our patrons. So we are going to moving more and more content to Patreon. Please consider becoming a patron. And you'll get all your questions asked, answered, longer versions of the podcast. We're also doing bonus interviews there as well by paying the subscription to Patreon. I barely make any money off this. We pay freelance writers. We make donations to a great nonprofit in Italy, and we're just creating a great cultural community there as well. So consider becoming a patron. Okay, guys. So I'm beyond excited to welcome my dear friend, the Napoli Outsider. I know he's been itching to talk calcio because he messaged me recently asking to come back on. So we're going to do something a little bit different. He's enlightened us a ton with his knowledge on Napoli, which is really second to none. But what I wanted to do today was kind of talk to our friend about different topics in Serie A. So I sent him a bunch of questions. You're going to hear this in two parts. First one's going to be on our regular episode. Second part will be on Patreon only. But I think you'll really enjoy this conversation. So without further ado, Napoli Outsider, it's always fantastic to chat calcio with you. Bentornato to Calcio Land.
Thank you. Always enjoyable to be with you guys and talking calcio.
Okay. So listen, I know we're not going to talk much about Napoli, but let's start there. I'd be remiss not to ask you about the, at this point, it seems very, very likely that Osimhen will come in. He'll be the most expensive transfer in Napoli's history, assuming everything goes as is reported. So let me ask you, you're an astute observer, not just of Serie A, but football in general. How excited do you think Napoli fans should be about this signing? And what do you think he'll bring to the table, to the club?
Okay, first of all, they should be very excited. You know, when you look at the rising stars, the under 21 center forwards in world football coming up, obviously Kylian Mbappe, and unbelievably he's still 21, and Erling Haaland are the top guys. But in the very next year, there are three or four guys that are rising, and a couple of them will rise to superstardom. I think Osimhen is part of that group. You can plug in, I don't know, Mason Greenwood, even though he's not a center forward, but I mean, he's a very complete forward. He's in that group. Myron Bladu from AZ Alkmaar in the Netherlands, he's in that group. And even Dusan Vlahovic from Fiorentina. So he is one of the most exciting young forwards around. And, that's the favorite guy that Giuntoli and Gattuso have decided to bring on. I think the strategy is good because of the age, because of the potential. Now, he does signal, though, something that's very important, which is the style of play that Gattuso wants to employ. Because the thing is, Osimhen, he is really fast. He's very athletic. He is strong with his legs. He's very technical. But he's not a guy that plays great associative football. By that, I mean, he's not, you know, like a Milik or Mertens, you know, or Higuain, those kind of center forwards that participate a lot to the buildup of play. He can do that because he was born as a winger, basically, many years ago before converting to center forward. So he can do that. He has the technique and the skill, but he does not have the tactical aptitude just yet. He can grow into that, but right now he is just a center forward who can transition really fast from defense to the offense. He's I don't want to call him just a counter attacker because that would be very limited. But that's something that he does really well. He can really rush down the field at full pace. And when you think that Napoli does have Lozano, even though Lozano is being kind of stonewalled, and the other guy they were really interested in is Boga, these are all sprinters. And I think it signals a very important intention by Gattuso for the next year. Now, to just go back just a little bit to Gattuso's time at Napoli, you have to see what happened. He started off with a 4-3-3, and that was not working. He was trying to play the Sarri way, basically, and that was just not working. Then after Napoli-Fiorentina, he switched to a 4-1-4-1 formation with Demme dropping deep and basically two lines of four, and they played a lot more defensive football. And that fixed a lot of issues. Napoli basically, well, they went on a winning streak that basically ended only against Atalanta. There was the loss against Lecce, but that just seemed very casual. Until the game versus Atalanta, they played with that kind of system. After Atalanta, for whatever reason, they switched back to a 4-3-3, and the level of play plummeted again. They started giving up goals again, and even their wins have seemed a bit shaky. And in fact, Lobotka has played more than them, man. And because they have changed the system, they're back to a 4-3-3. But the thing is, Gattuso's system seems the defensive one, with a lot of counterattackers, which Napoli right now does not have, except for Lozano again. So I think it shows that Napoli's future, if he does arrive indeed, Osimhen, then is based on maybe less keeping hold of the ball. Right now, Napoli's first in Serie A for possession, and maybe a little more transition football, vertical football, faster-paced football. So I think that that could be an indication of things to come. Then again, you know, we need to see if it becomes official, when it becomes official, and what other moves come along with it. But he's a very different forward from Milik, from Mertens, from Llorente, and he offers something that currently is severely lacking in Napoli's roster, which is pace down the middle, pace in, among the center forwards.
Very, very interesting. Okay, so now we're going to pivot away from Napoli. I know you and I have discussed that we wanted to talk about other calcio stuff. So I'm sorry to start on this note, but I have to ask you this. I have to say, you know, I fell in love with Sarri at Empoli, his time at Napoli. For a long time, I figured it would be years until I enjoyed watching a Serie A team as much Sarri, but Sarri is Napoli. But I have to say, this Atalanta is really something. So I want to ask you, you know, obviously Napoli Sarri got to over 90s point. Atalanta's definitely not to get to that, but they did well in the Champions League. If you, can you make a case that this current Atalanta is even a better team than Sarri's best Napoli, or do you think this is a prisoner of the moment take to feel that way?
Well, it really depends. I mean, if you're looking at a full season, there's no question that Sarri's Napoli was better for me. But if you're looking on a single game, I think Atalanta is better. I mean, on their day, they can literally beat anybody. Over a full season, no. I mean, the results are there. You can see what happened. And Atalanta did make it to the quarterfinals of the Champions League. But remember, they made it through with 7 points in the group phase, and then they beat Valencia, which didn't even qualify for Europe this year. So really, to get where they got, to get where they arrived, they had to beat Shakhtar, Dinamo Zagreb, and Valencia. And the first two, they only just beat them. I mean, with 7 points, a lot of teams go out of the Champions League. We went out of the Champions League with 12 and 11 points, so we know about that. So you need a little bit of luck. And they're not even going to equal the points that Napoli had in, well, in fact, probably they're not going to equal any of Sarri's three seasons at Napoli with the points. So, you know, that's the thing. I don't think over a full season they're just as good. But they can be better than anybody on their day. And I think it boils down to this. Sarri's Napoli was a very good team. It had a lot of skills, a lot of technique. But the thing is, you could never make a case that they were the best in the world at something. I mean, they were really great at positional football. It was entertaining to watch them play intricate moves, intricate passes. But you would have never said they did that better than Manchester City or better than Barcelona. You could just not make that argument. That wouldn't have been serious. On the other hand, Atalanta is the best in the world at something, which is probably they're the most muscular and athletic team in the world. So when they're on their day and it becomes a muscular game, well, they can beat anybody just because there's nobody that does what they do as well as they do. And that's the big difference. Obviously, it's not easy to do that for the full season over 50-plus games. So, yeah, they have their moments. They go up and down. And obviously, you know, I mean, it has been spoken about. There are some seeping accusations because whenever some team's just muscularly superior or athletically superior to everybody else to this extent, you know, people are going to say, you know, that there's something strange or illicit going on. Now,
yeah, we also know that in Italy, everyone will forgive everything except for someone's success. So I also think that that's a typical Italian thing too.
Yeah, that is true. So, but the point is, you know, I'm not gonna support those accusations or anything, even though the defenses that I've heard about them are even weaker than the accusations themselves, because people are pointing out that in terms of kilometers, you know, that they run per game, they're not out of line. Well, that does not mean anything. I mean, we could go on and on for the reason for which it doesn't mean anything. But the point is, if people are making those accusations, there are two reasons, obviously. One is that, as you pointed out, there's a lot of jealousy and there's a lot of envy, and that just plays into it.
Yeah.
But the second reason is also that they really look unnaturally strong and unnaturally fast. And again, on their day, you cannot do anything. They will just out-muscle you off the ball. The game against Napoli, for example, was just a fine example. Napoli came into that game having rotated most of its team. So that meant that, you know, everybody else, like I think six or seven guys, came into that game having rested in the 7 days prior to the game. And Atalanta, on the other hand, had not rotated at all. And Napoli had been training for a little longer. They had been training well because they even had the Italian Cup to warm up and everything. And yet, Atalanta, with tired players, just destroyed Napoli physically. The first half, it was an even game. And then as the second half started, they had twice as much energy as Napoli. They played 15 minutes, which Napoli, just running circles around Napoli players, essentially. And then it became an even game again. And what was incredible was, for example, seeing Papu Gomez, aged probably 52 or something like that, just sprinting all across the field at about 75 minutes on the clock and saving an occasion, like kicking the ball into a corner kick, just saving an occasion against a Napoli player. And that's incredible. That's just something that does not happen. So it strikes the eye. And what is more interesting even was that Napoli actually even made the substitutions around the 60th minute. Atalanta only had one substitution in the 72nd minute, and then they did not have any other substitutions until something like 5 or 6 minutes from time. And yet, they were the more athletic team on the pitch. Now, again, when that happens, that just shows you how superior they are. It's probably because of training methods. It might be something else. I don't know. But the thing is, they are the best in the world at this. So, and this goes for Paris Saint-Germain as well, you know. If it becomes an athletic game, a muscular game, you know, they can go all the way in the Champions League. It's three games, essentially, over something like 10 days. And they are the fittest team to go there. So on their day, they can do whatever they want. They are the top athletic team in the world. But over the full season, no, they're not just not up to that Napoli. They're not up to other teams even in this league. I mean, if you look at them, you think they're the best team in Serie A. And yet, they're just 1 point ahead of Lazio as we speak. They're in third place in Serie A. I mean, when you see them play and then you look at the Serie A standings, it almost seems disappointing because they should be on top of the league, really. And so that tells you a lot over what they can do over a full season. But watch out for what they can do over a single game, and watch out for what they might be able to do in the Champions League, because you never know.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And as usual, you have a very wise perspective, not too prisoner of the moment by any means. So let's talk about Lazio, obviously, today against Juve. They were decimated. It's amazing how much their season has changed since Calcio came back. So let me ask you, if you were advising Lotito and Tare, what would be your approach this summer? Would your approach be, you know what, before the break, we were really close, had the season maybe not stopped, we could have gone all the way. Do you try and bring back the gang all together as much as possible? Or do you see this as the perfect time to try to rebuild and say, you know what, that's as far as our team went. Now would be the right time to try to change the cycle. What would you do?
It depends on the market for me, because if really good offers come in for certain players, I'm thinking especially guys like Correa or, I don't know, maybe even Acerbi and Immobile, of course, because of his age as well, I would probably sell. And the reason for that is, this year, it's not just it was the perfect storm, but you have to figure out, you know, what we said the last time we spoke. Last year, we're going to crumble. They had no chance. They wouldn't have crumbled in the first two or three games, but they would have eventually because they had a really short roster. And that just wore out on them when they had to play every 3 days. So this year, they could make a challenge. They could mount a challenge because they punted on the Europa League. They didn't care about it at all. They didn't really care about the Italian Cup either, where they were beaten by Napoli in the quarterfinals. So they could only play one game a week. So it was a 38-game season for them, really, effectively. Now, when they COVID just really destroyed them, gave them no chance because it transformed a one-game-a-week situation into a two-game-per-week situation, and that was too much for them. They just crumbled. But again, what does this mean? It tells us that for next year, when they will not be able to punt in the Champions League is not the Europa League, they just will not be up to standards unless they invest a lot of money, probably way more than Lotito is willing to invest, over deepening the roster. So if you're not going to really get 6 or 7 quality players that can rotate in and out regularly without losing quality, then you might as well just sell and try to rebuild. Because, I mean, Lotito is never going to keep everybody while adding literally 6 or 7 players. And if he's not going to do that, then Lazio are not going to be able to challenge because their roster is not going to be deep. They're going to run into many of the same situations that we saw late this year. So if you're not going to do that, you might as well just rebuild and keep maybe the 2 or 3 guys who make that team special. I don't know if you can keep Sergei Milinkovic-Savic. You can keep Luis Alberto. I don't know if you can keep them. Maybe you can keep Lazzari. You can keep Luis Felipe. You can keep Strakosha, and then you build around them. You try to do something. But again, I don't see them as contenders next year unless Lotito goes on a spending spree, literally, which he's never done.
Yeah, not to say the least. Okay, so let's talk about the other team that we saw today. I definitely want to ask you about some new additions, but I mean, at this point, Juve has all but clinched the title. So let me ask you, how do you think this is going to be remembered? Can you make maybe the case this is maybe the weakest Juve out of these 9 titles, and maybe the other teams didn't had some opportunities or didn't do the most of it? Or do you think that's maybe being a little bit unfair to Juve and Sarri?
No, it's definitely the way you said it. I mean, they're definitely the worst Juve champions. And, you know, this might sound like sour grapes, but I feel that, you know, this was the year that Napoli didn't have to fail because they would have been able to challenge, but they did fail. So that's on Napoli, obviously. But if you just look at Juventus singularly, I mean, this is what we said when we came out of the lockdown. We said Juventus was going to stumble to the goal, but it was going to be stumbling unchallenged. And that's what happened because the other teams are just way too flawed to mount a challenge. At the same time, Juventus was just not unbeatable at all. It's just not a good team. I mean, Sarri went there. His goal was not just win the Scudetto. I mean, they've been able to do that with Estigarribia, Matri, Vucinic, and all that. I mean, that's not the point. The point was he was going to go there, make them play exciting football, attractive football, and change the culture, basically change what was happening on the pitch. But what we saw this year is, yes, I will concede it was a different Juventus team. They tried to keep the ball a little more. They tried to play more passes, maybe stay further up with the line. You could see some ideas, but they never played attractive football. And in the last 30 or 40 meters from the goal, they were always relying on the plays of their great players. So really, honestly, you could do that with Allegri, except that Sarri at the same time lost a lot of solidity at the back. They, you know, they were up 2-0 against Milan and they lost. They were up 2-0 with Sassuolo. They were up 2-0 with Lazio, and Lazio was, in the end, they just brought on some guys I'd never even heard of. And probably there were some spectators. They were guys from the Primavera, obviously, like some kids. But that's the point. And they almost conceded the second goal as well on that Milinkovic-Savic free kick. So the point is they lost a lot of solidity in the back without gaining more goals on the front and without playing more attractive football. And I'm not going to argue on the legitimacy of the penalty kicks that they've had in the last few games because most of them were pretty unarguable. You know, you might say, Muriel giving up that penalty was lucky. Well, it might have been, but it was a penalty. You cannot argue with that. But the point is, they did not create many chances. Most of their goals in the last few games came from corner kicks and penalties. What does that tell you? It tells you that they're just not building up well, not attractive, not effective, and they're giving up too many goals at the back. Their defense has been the worst Juventus defense since they went on this run, and by a huge margin. And also their points total. If they win every game, if they win out, they're going to be on 92 points, which is 2 points more than last year. So you might say, hey, they improved. But not quite. Because last year, I think Allegri only had 3 points in the last 5 games because they had already won the league mathematically. Because otherwise, he would have finished about 100. So basically, Juventus kicked it down a notch this year by far from every point of view. So basically, the only way this can be considered, and they also lost, by the way, the Super Cup and the Italian Cup.
Yeah.
So Juventus have never been as beatable, and yet they didn't even get close to being beaten. I think this is a huge indictment of the Italian league. I think it looks bad on the Italian league that Juventus play so poorly. It's kind of the Bayern situation. Bayern, for two times in the last few years, have had a terrible start to the league. They even had to kick out their coach, and then they still cruise to victory. And it's kind of the same. There's a team that's so superior that even when they do everything wrong, they still win and win comfortably. And that's a situation that needs to be addressed. And maybe we'll talk about it more in depth another time, because otherwise it could go on for about an hour talking about competitive advantage and stuff like that. But the point is, Juventus were vulnerable, looked vulnerable, and yet they won. But I'm sorry, I just did not enjoy watching them. I felt it was like an Allegri team with less solidity at the back.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair description. So now let's look a little bit to the future. With Juve, I want to ask you to predict, who do you think is going to have a better Juve career between Kulusevski, who I think is an absolute stud, and Arthur, who arrives from Barcelona in the deal with Pjanic? How do you see these guys fitting in at Juve, and if you have to bet, which of these two is going to have a better career at Juve?
I know I'm always boring, but I'm always going to kind of always answer, it depends. In this situation, for me, it depends on who the coach is going to be. Because, for example, if Allegri had been the coach, I would have told you definitely Kulusevski, like by miles and miles. With Sarri, it could be Arthur. Arthur is a special kind of player for me in certain aspects, but he needs to be nurtured or he's going to disappear. That's what he showed at Barcelona. He is a special kind of player, and he would fit Sarri's play in a team like the one he had at Napoli. But by the way he's played it with Juventus, I just don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, obviously, he's got to change some things. And as I said, this year was just not up to par for me in terms of aesthetics. Certainly, Arthur helps him go into that direction. Kulusevski a little less, probably, because he does not fit the exact mold of a Sarri player. He is more of an Allegri player for me. So I still think Kulusevski is a better player. I think he's a stud. I agree with you. But if Sarri stays on as a coach, Arthur just might get just a little more chances to become good. So, but if they change the coach, I'm going to pick Kulusevski every day.
Okay. All right. So now let's shift to Milan. I'm very curious to get your take on this. Before we talk about Rangnick, let's talk about, you know, the team right now. Obviously, they've been, you know, I would say with Atalanta and Sassuolo, the most impressive team since Calcio came back. In your opinion, who has more to do with Milan's resurgence this year between Pioli and Ibrahimovic?
Well, first of all, you said it right in asking the question. You said who has more to do with it, because the fact is both of them do. It's just a matter of finding out who has more.
Yep.
Now, Ibrahimovic really had a big impact because you need some veteran leadership on some teams, especially a team as young as Milan. And it limits the amount of unprofessionalism that goes on. That's something I think that Inter lacked this year. That's something that Napoli lacked this year. They lacked a leader like that, that would just, you know, I mean, Ibrahimovic is kind of a character, but when you're talking about how professional he is,
yeah,
you really cannot argue with that. He's a pro's pro. And, I mean, you see guys like Allan and Milik at Napoli, or what Lautaro Martinez has been doing at Inter, you know, players just thinking about their future and basically forgetting how to perform on the pitch in the last few months, that would not have happened with Ibrahimovic around. Now, that being said, all this credit being given to Ibrahimovic about the leadership, I think it's Pioli has more to do with it. He really gave stability to the team. He made everybody improve, really. There's not a single player that did not improve lately, probably. Maybe I don't know the wingbacks, except for Theo Hernandez, who's been outstanding. I'm thinking about the right wingbacks, literally. Everybody else, even Frank Kessié, has been fantastic lately. So he's given everybody the right role. He's been finding the right spots to play players, giving them confidence. I still think he's not a superstar coach, which might be unfair, but he's definitely somebody who doesn't do anything weird. He just does the right things. I think he's the type of coach that does not add maybe too much to the team, but he's not going to do magic, but he's going to get the best out of his players. And, you know, they call him, they used to call him the normalizer. And that's kind of what he is. He will not, you know, he's not the chosen one or anything like that. But he does his job pretty well. And when you are in dire straits and you call on him, he's not going to do anything to hurt the club. He's going to help it.
Okay, so now let's talk about a Milan transitioning away from Pioli. It seems all but done that Ragnić is going to be the new, he'll be in charge basically about everything. So what do you make about this move? Obviously, Pioli has the team going in the right direction, but Milan's going for a big change in philosophy. What do you make about this decision, and what do you think Ragnić will do at Milan?
That's a very good question, because you see, Italy, one of the biggest defects of Italy is you never give any time to someone to work through the issues that he might have to address.
Yeah.
Now, a guy like Ralf Rangnick, you cannot get him just to coach and expect an immediate impact. If you do that, he might give it to you still, because you never know, but that's not why you bring him on. You bring him on to change the culture of the club. And I'm not talking about the first team culture. I'm talking about literally the whole club's culture, how scouting is done, how player development is done, how players transition from the youth ranks to the first team, how the first team has to approach games. And I'm not talking about, you know, tactics like a 4-3-3, 4-4-2, whatever. No, I'm talking about the philosophy that surrounds the whole soccer club. Now, if they give him time to transform the whole organization from the top to the bottom, then that's going to be good. Now, he succeeded in doing that in Germany, because obviously he was in a club that had a lot of organizational expectations, but they had all the time that he needed. And they were willing to wait for these things to come through, and obviously the rise was gradual. With Milan, that's not going to happen. Now, let's suppose that Milan just have, like, I don't know, 7 points after 10 games. That's not going to sit well with anybody. But the point is that you do not have to look at what he does in the first year. You have to look at how things change over time. If they are willing to maybe sit through one or two hard seasons, which won't necessarily happen, but might happen, well, then it's a good call. On the other hand, if you're going to treat him the way coaches and managers are usually treated in Italy, then it's a bad idea, because there is a strong, strong risk that he goes through a settle down period in which he has to settle down, and that period doesn't end. Because that's what usually happens in Italy. There's no patience at all. And you need to have patience when you pick a guy like this. And, you know, picking a guy like this ahead of Pioli, it doesn't mean that Pioli has done a bad job or anything like that.
Yeah.
But it means you're trying to change the culture. It means you're looking not 1 year into the future. You're not looking at 2020, 2021. You're looking at what's going to happen from 2021 through 2025 and even beyond. So you're looking over the long term. And that's why it's not an indictment of Pioli. It's just a way of saying, hey, this is what we want our organization to look like. And, you know, again, you need patience, though. If you're going to have it, I think it's a good call. It's a really good call. The impact he's been having in Germany, I'm not going to say it's as far-fetched. It's not hard as in-depth as the one Cruyff had on Barcelona, because obviously that's historical. But it is philosophically the same. You know, it's a man that changed the culture of an organization. We have to point this out, and that's why I tried to repeat it three or four times, because it's not about the first team. It's about what happens on the field with the first team, but it's also about what happens around it, on top, on the bottom, with the scouting, with everything else. It's about how a club organization is being run. So you need to have a lot of patience with him.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting to me, too, is, you know, in Italy, especially when a foreign coach comes with so much hype and so much, you know, expectations on what he's going to do, he won't have it easy with the press in Italy, especially if he gets off to a slow start.
You know how, I mean,
go ahead.
Well, look, I totally agree. I mean, you remember the way Benitez was treated. I mean, he was almost insulted by the media. Mourinho was better equipped to deal with the stuff, but he had to deal with so much stuff despite being a winner. I mean, if that's the way they treat people who are proven winners, then how are they going to treat somebody who comes in and essentially has to impose his own philosophy, his own foreign philosophy, over Calcio? I mean, obviously, you know, you're going to have a lot of media guys, you know, smiling and laughing. Oh, so this is the Rangnick way after a defeat or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, he's going to be treated very poorly if he does fail. If he does succeed, they're going to smile. They're going to treat him well. And then at the first defeat, they're going to go in heavy on him. And I think Milan have to know this. If they don't, they're in big trouble.
I agree.